Welcome to PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lenman. My guest today is Rick Rozoff. Rick provides a very important service. He's the editor of the Stop NATO website. Why is NATO important? NATO is important because it's done so much harm to so many people in so many places for so long, especially since the 1990s. That on the one hand. On the other hand, it doesn't get the attention in the news that it should. Oh, NATO gets mentioned often enough. Some of the countries, America, maybe Turkey, Britain, France, it comes up in the news, but it's almost a sidelight topic. The subjects that are discussed make the headlines, and if NATO's mentioned, it's almost in footnote fashion. So people who read what's going on, who know anything about what's going on, and too few do, they simply don't understand the role that NATO plays. It's a U.S.-led organization. Heaven knows what it has in mind ahead. Well, Rick knows a lot about what it has in mind ahead. We're going to talk about that. We'll talk about some of the things going on now. I'm focusing very heavily on Syria because I expect much more serious U.S.-led aggression against the country. I can smell it coming. How and in what fashion? We'll wait and see. There's a so-called Geneva II peace conference that maybe it will, maybe it won't convene. We have to wait. Geneva 1 was a year ago this month. Geneva 2 was planned early in June. Then it was late in June. Now it's July. Well, we'll wait and see what happens. It doesn't matter because Geneva 1 failed. Geneva 2 won't fare any better. The plans are already drawn. They go through this exercise. It's an exercise in futility is the best way to describe it. Rick, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Stephen. It's always an honor, and it's a pleasure, and it's a learning experience to be on your program. I appreciate the opportunity.
Oh, it's a learning experience for me. Let's talk about NATO first. You talk about NATO as a global missile. I think that explains NATO very, very well, especially with its expansion plans. Explain that to listeners.
Yes, I mean, global NATO is not a term that opponents of the aggressive military bloc like ourselves have coined as a term. It's one that they acknowledge themselves. A speech by the current Secretary General of NATO, Denmark's Anders Fogh Rasmussen, within the last year, maybe 18 months, a brief speech, maybe of 20 paragraphs, contained words like global, globally, globalization, international, world, and so forth. I think I counted 40 times. In a brief speech, so it's a role that NATO arrogates onto itself. That is the right to portray itself as a global security provider. However, I think more strikingly than that, because we're not dealing with a completely above the board operation. Of course, when you're dealing with aggressive military imperialism, they're not going to tell you what they're really doing. They're going to give gloss over it and give you a euphemistic understanding of it. And the current U.S. ambassador to NATO, who is somebody born in the Netherlands, by the way, to stress the transatlantic ties of the elites that ultimately compose the leadership of NATO, establish NATO, and exploit NATO to maintain Western domination, not only of the Europe and the Mediterranean, North Africa region, but ultimately the world, is a man called Ivo Dalder. Dalder, and he wrote in 2006, he co-authored an article that appeared in the publication of the Council on Foreign Relations in the United States entitled Global NATO. So this is, and now as he's the major permanent representative, envoy, or ambassador to NATO, because the U.S. is the leader of the organization, is the dominant force in the organization, here's somebody who 7 years ago told you he was advocating for a global NATO, and now he's been in a position to implement that. So, we're not talking about metaphorical or hyperbolical term here. We're talking about quite literally what NATO intends to do. And as we've talked about on your show before, Stephen, shortly before the last NATO summit here in Chicago in May of last year, NATO initiated the latest of several major partnership programs spanning the entire globe, which is called, aptly enough, Partners Across the Globe. So they visualize themselves as being history's first international military bloc, the largest in history. It's 28 full members and perhaps 45 or more partners almost everywhere around the world.
Oh, it's so true, Rick. And the so-called high priests of globalization, the Bilderberg Group, they envision NATO at some point as being a global military force, literally militarizing the entire planet under the NATO banner to serve their interests, which is a world composed of rulers and serfs on a global basis. Talk about a future too grim to imagine, Rick.
I'm glad you raised that, the first meeting of the Bilderberg Group, named because of the location in the Netherlands where it was held, Prince Bernhard, a Nazi, and the creation of the prototypes of the European Union and that of NATO in 1949, all more or less overlap in terms of time, certainly in terms of purpose. And what we see is the lingering or fading, one hopes, residue of 500 years of European colonialism, trying to hold on to its colonies at the end of World War II. And we have to remember that, France, Britain, Spain, Portugal, the Netherlands itself, later in the game, Germany and Italy were major colonial powers in Africa and the Middle East and Asia and the South Pacific and Latin America and in the Caribbean, Central and South America. And that, faced with the emergence of a truly multipolar world at the end of World War II, that is with the emergence of the Soviet Union as a continental power in Europe after its defeat of, the Nazi Wehrmacht, the rebirth of China as a political entity, the anti-colonial movement, and so forth, that the Prince Bernhards of the world had to scramble to hold on to what they could. Now, conversely, by 1991, with the dissolution of the Soviet Union, the breakup of the Eastern European Comecon economic bloc and the Warsaw Pact military alliance, those same Western powers, Stephen, saw themselves positioned to reclaim, make good their losses, from the end of World War I through, the anti-colonial period of the 50s and 60s, and reassert the West as the dominant military power. You were talking about, people cringing, before power and the elites, that I can't say govern them, but rule over them. And one is reminded of the actual characterization of the sort of partners we're talking about, partners of the United States and NATO throughout the world, in the terms of Zbigniew Brzezinski, one of the architects, the current state of the unipolar world, in his late 1990s book, The Grand Chessboard, referred to as vassals and tributaries. And, that is precisely what NATO partners in North Africa and the Middle East and the Caucasus, Central Asia, East Asia, and so forth are. They're military, economic, and political vassals and tributaries of the United States.
And this is exactly what's been going on, Rick, with one imperial war after another, literally seamless wars, either one segue into another, or multiple ones going on at the same time. I talk about direct and proxy wars. I talk about Obama waging direct and proxy wars. There's still conflict going on in Iraq. Libya is a cauldron of violence. The Afghan war is the only war that most people realize there's a war still going on there, and the so-called peace talks they're talking about with the Taliban. Well, the Taliban aren't going to make any concessions to Washington. They have been fighting since October 2001 to throw it all away and say, we love you guys. We didn't really mean to do this.
Inversely, the flip side of the coin, is that the U.S., after having, waged 12 years of war in that poor, godforsaken nation that's been through so much because of the U.S., which really started the armed conflict in Afghanistan in 1978 with Saudi money and Pakistani military and intelligence, infrastructural support, launching the Mujahideen war against the government in Kabul in 78. And, even before the first Soviet troops stepped inside the country, we have to recollect something, again, that Zbigniew Brzezinski openly acknowledges, in fact, boasts of, having pulled off. But you've described perfectly, to absolute perfection, the fact that you were dealing with a seamless series of wars. We're really dealing with what some people, I think, correctly have characterized as World War III, but not simultaneously on all fronts, but in fact, successively or sequentially, as you've described it. But also, as you indicate, it's not simply the war in Afghanistan, which will continue, under a different guise, of course. It's a fact, as you indicate, that the U.S. is simultaneously waging direct, either aerial warfare, drone warfare, counterinsurgency operations, or directly or by proxy, as you state, in at least a dozen nations. We're talking about The continuation in Afghanistan periodically across the border in Pakistan, in Yemen, in Somalia. In Mali, U.S. military forces have been engaged in counterinsurgency operations for several years in Mali, you know, before the French came in last year. The U.S. is still actively, its military is actively involved in counterinsurgency operations against Marxist political groupings in Colombia, the Armed Revolutionary Forces of Colombia, in the Philippines, the New People's Army, and in Turkey, the Kurdistan Workers' Party. So, you know, and this is under the guise of fighting Islamic extremism. You know, they're cleaning up, if you will, you know, the or make, putting the final stamp on its Cold War, you know, the campaign against leftist insurgencies or opposition groups throughout the world. This is only a small part of it. So, you know, we've just added up, I think, here, you know, probably 10 or 12 countries where the U.S. is waging some sort of military operations, what can only be characterized as war.
Oh, indeed. I mean, imperial lawlessness writ large, Rick. Before the Soviet Union dissolved in December 1991, the great Satan was a communist led by the former Soviet Union. And when the Soviet Union dissolved, I think the war planners in the Pentagon and the White House and Congress went apoplectic. I mean, they needed a new enemy. So they decided that they'd go after Islamic extremists. Well, they had Saddam to deal with, and he came right out of room service, a former ally.
Good point.
Transformed into a convenient enemy, and they got rid of him, and they killed heaven knows how many Iraqis. The sanctions alone, the estimates run maybe 1.5 million in the 1990s. I've got an article I'll put out tomorrow on Bill Clinton just having won the Israeli Presidential Medal of Freedom. It's also called the President's Medal. And one war criminal awarded another war criminal the medal, Shimon Peres, who won America's Presidential Medal of Freedom, Presidential Medal of Freedom, I believe it's called, and that was some months ago, and I wrote about him. I mean, his record is worse than Clinton's because he's been doing it for four decades or longer. He's 90 years old now. So they had a celebration in Jerusalem. People like Barbara Streisand showed up.
Robert De Niro and Sharon Stone. But Tony Blair introduced the 90-year-old Shimon Peres with statements to the effect that in England we have the Queen, in Israel you have Peres. And this is, you know, you were talking about Bill Clinton, who went out of his way, not for any out of any political motivation, but for, you know, he's, you know, definitely very adept at advancing his own interests, but to avoid conscription into the U.S. Armed Forces during the war in Vietnam. But in 2002, after he left the White House, he spoke at a banquet where he stated that if Iraqi troops were to cross the Jordan River, you know, likely prospect, right, and threaten Israel, that he, Bill Clinton, would grab a gun, get in a trench, and fight and die. He would fight and die for Israel. You know, while drafting the dodge, of course, you know, drafting rather, you know, conscription of the U.S. Army during the war in Vietnam. So you know, this is what you're dealing with.
You know, the chicken hawks.
Yes, I mean, he wouldn't have done either, of course, let's
Dick
be honest.
Dick Cheney, the other scoundrels around him. I don't know if Rumsfeld ever served in the military. I don't know if Wolfowitz ever served. I think the last notable person who served in a U.S. war, what John Kerry did in Vietnam, Bush won, of course, in World War II. I mean, these people don't fight in wars. They send other people to fight their wars. They wouldn't dare. It's not a matter of getting their hands dirty. They don't want to risk getting hurt. So they stay behind. They send these other people to go. Tomorrow I've got a scathing article on Bill Clinton. I've written a little about him before. I started my writing, Rick, really after he was long out of office. I've savaged him for the economic policies that he instituted, getting rid of Glass-Steagall and the Commodity Futures Modernization Act that literally turned Wall Street more than ever into the casino it is now. And as bad as grand theft was before these laws were passed, right at the end of his second term, it literally was no holds barred, deregulated. Grab all you want, steal all you want. We're with you all the way. You know, just give us good campaign contributions, and you'll last.
No, within the final hours of his presidency in January,
right.
Of, you know, he pardoned Mark Rich, who was you know, accused of involvement in the largest embezzlement in the history of the United States.
Well, I wrote an article called "Israeli War Criminal of the Year," that was on. Obama. Obama getting the same award that Clinton got on the 19th. Today is the 21st. So 2 days ago, Clinton was in Jerusalem. He got this award. And I liked the title of my article, so I simply made it another Israeli War Criminal of the Year award. And it's a scathing article on Bill Clinton. It goes over his imperial and his domestic policy. It'll be on my blog site tomorrow, Steve Lenman blog. Read it if you want to know about the real Bill Clinton. I guarantee you that what I said is absolute fact. Everything I say in the article can be checked. Oh, there can always be a mistake or two along the way. But basically, the way I outlined his policies, domestic and foreign, it basically tells you what the real Bill Clinton was, and he continues to be. He's done hell on Haitians since he left office. He's tried to literally turn the nation into a militarized corporate free trade zone. That's another story altogether. I left that out of my article. I concentrated on what he did during his 8 years in office. Probably the greatest crime was what he did against the Iraqis, the sanctions for 8 years, that two humanitarian, oil for food humanitarian coordinators, Hans von Spanik and Dennis Halliday, they both resigned, and Halliday yeah. was most explicit, saying he wanted no role in being part of genocide, and he defined what he meant by genocide. It was the murder of 7,000 Iraqi children every single month for 8 years under Clinton. And before yeah. Clinton came in office and continued until the Bush's war of 2003. Well, that's just one episode. There's a lot more.
Yeah, I'm glad you helped knock the halo or the nimbus off the head of this sociopath and war criminal, who is still is idolized by vast sectors of, for lack of a better term, liberal left, people who identify themselves as liberal left in the United States, who I'm sure if he, could run for a third term, would vote for him overwhelmingly, which is really an indictment of, the moral and political state of affairs in the United States right now. But we do have to recall also that, he bombed Iraq regularly in an enforcement of the so-called free fly zone, and that most monstrously, and this alone, in any sane, civilized, moral world, would have this man in handcuffs for the rest of his life, is on the very eve of the U.S. Congress voting impeachment against him in December of 1998. He and his buddy Tony Blair launched, I believe, literally over 200 cruise missiles inside Iraq simply to distract people's attention.
Isn't that what they always do?
For that, and killed who knows how many hundreds of innocent Iraqis, and a crime of that nature and that magnitude, and the fact that nobody has really called him on that when everyone knows what the true nature of that attack was. It was actually called Operation Desert Fox, as I recall, right?
I think that's right. I mentioned in my article that he intermittently bombed Iraq throughout the period that he was president, and heaven knows how many Iraqis were killed just in the bombings. We don't know that, but such a terrible, terrible toll. And literally, he committed genocide against innocent Iraqi people who deserve better, and he simply didn't give a damn. And he waltzes around like a sovereign, and he gets these awards. It's not the only one he's won. He's rich.
No, that's another question. How many tens of millions, perhaps hundreds of millions of dollars has he made on so-called honoraria, payback?
Oh, absolutely.
Since he left office?
Absolutely. He gets paid six figures to give a speech. I wouldn't listen to one of his speeches if somebody paid me to do it. And he literally waltzes around the world giving these speeches, getting paid six figures for it. And he poses as a legitimate Democrat. He went out with very high approval ratings, Rick. The difference between him and Obama is that people are going through hard times today. The 1990s, people in America had relatively good economic times. They were getting, they were going down because of the offshoring of good jobs and the lowering of living standards. The class war has been raging in America since the 1970s. So this is a long-term project that's been going on for a long time. But it was mitigated to some extent during the 1980s, and especially during the 1990s. There were good times for people. Jobs were fairly easy to get then, even if they weren't the best jobs. So it was easy for people to think kindly of, more kindly of Clinton, but now people are going through terrible duress, but it still hasn't taken the toll of Obama. I think Clinton left office with something like maybe a mid-60s approval rating, and Obama has hovered around 50% for a very long time. I simply can't conceive of how half the country can support Obama after all the harm he's done to Americans, Rick, let alone what he's done abroad to Americans, the harm that he's inflicted, and yet the people, probably the people he's harmed most, plus the acolytes that hang on and benefit from him, are the ones who give him the best support. The Republicans who simply want a Republican in office are the ones who oppose him.
Yes. You know, by the way, I wanted to applaud you for an article of yours, I take it of 2 days ago, with the title Fast Tracking Towards War on Syria. And it contains, you know, something that people don't think often enough about using, which is, you know, reaching into the true democratic legacy of our nation and of, you know, the Republican small case, our movement as a whole. And I'm going to, you know, quote them if you don't mind. These are from your article, and now you have to thank you for finding them. But one is a quote from Thomas Jefferson, who says, "When people fear the government, there is tyranny. When the government fears the people, there is liberty." And you also quote Thomas Paine saying, the duty of a true patriot is to protect his country from its government. And I think these things now are considered to be lèse majesté, right? They're considered to be crimes against the state to talk like this, to quote Thomas Jefferson or Thomas Paine. And the fact that, you know, some insidious form of statism is seized on the minds of people, and unfortunately, you know, more arguably on the so-called liberal left, again, even than on the right, where this idea that somehow the state, far from being, as, you know, Lenin once defined it, a mechanism by which one state, one class oppresses another, has suddenly turned into some beneficent power that mediates disputes between classes and social groupings, and that, you know, is our savior. And then there is an intentional conflation or confusion about state as opposed to, say, nation, country, and people. You know, Randolph Byrne, the great American, you know, analyst and writer of a century ago, made that distinction, you know, in his work on the state, that it is a role of politicians to portray their administration as being the state is representing the nation is representing the country, and the country is representing the people, when in fact, you know, the state and the nation have to earn the right to be seen as representatives of the people and the country.
Absolutely, Rick.
Nothing to the state but the other way around, right?
Indeed. Rick, several times in the past, I've quoted Jefferson from the Declaration of Independence, and he may have had help writing it, but basically what the Declaration of Independence says, people ought to read and go and see exactly what that document says. It basically says, when governments ill-serve the people, when they betray them, it is the duty and obligation of the people to get rid of the government and institute one that will serve all the people. Now, Thomas Jefferson said that. I didn't. If it was good enough for Jefferson, it's good enough for me.
You know, heaven help him being alive today and speaking on any social media that's being tracked by the National Security Agency, because this man has just got himself a nice NSA file, hasn't he? A dossier. You know, for using incendiary terms, words like that.
Well, there'd probably be a CIA hit squad getting rid of him just the way they got rid of Kennedy.
He'll be in a cell next to Julian Assange, Manning.
No, indeed. The name of the game is silencing these people so they don't make any more quote-unquote mischief. And Jefferson, by current standards, absolutely was a mischief maker. And he certainly wasn't the only one. Benjamin Franklin said, paraphrasing him, that anyone who thinks they can give up some freedoms for security ends up losing both. And that's exactly true. So people literally get mesmerized, Rick, to believe that, a lot of Americans think NSA spying is good, that we need to rout out our enemies to protect the nation. They're literally so stupid, they don't realize that what's going on is literally a war on free expression, a war on democratic rights, literally a war on humanity. And the notion of giving up some freedoms for security, you're damn well going to lose both of them, and that's the name of the game. Unchallenged hegemonic dominance with no rights whatsoever. Again, going back to the Bilderbergs, they simply don't want to be challenged. They want one size fits all on a global scale, a ruler serf society, ordinary people, which means most everybody, have no rights, and this elite, minute fraction of 1% are the rulers of the world, and they decide everything. Well, that's the name of the game that we have to fight, and if we don't fight it, that's the kind of world we're going to get.
No, you're right, and you know we would have to go back 250 years, you know, to come up with that sort of thinking before, during the age of absolute monarchy, right? Where you know, French monarch Louis XIV says, you know, l'état c'est moi, you know, the state is me. But now, you know, indeed, you've got an even more refined elitist, aristocratic, you know, view of the world that the very sort you describe have some inherent, you know, inborn right to govern their inferiors. you know, as though they're to the manor born, and they have the right to, you know, determine what the Untermensch, you know, are to be, how they're to be handled and so forth. I mean, it reeks, you know, unfortunately, of unctuous self-righteousness into the bargain. So it becomes responsibility to protect, and it becomes looking out after our, you know, poor, forlorn, ungovernable brothers in other parts of the world. And, you know, the white man's burden has become a, you know, a particularly egregious phenomenon in the post-Cold War period. And we have to, you know, acknowledge again that the, you know, 22 years or so ago, I think formally with the dissolution of the Soviet Union, with the breakup of that country into its 15 constituent republics, whatever one thought of the nation, it ensured a system of bipolarity in the world. Not multipolarity, which would be a far more preferable model, but at least there was some break on U.S. and general Western, you know, designs for global domination and so forth. You know, absent that for the last 22 years, what we've seen is what, in another interview I did a couple of days ago, Steve, I described as a particularly voracious bear coming out of hibernation, and with a ravenous appetite that nothing less than the entire world will slake or satiate, and he's going to make up for lost time. And I think we have seen precisely that over the last 22 years. And the question of Bill Clinton, you know, because I know the inevitable, the way people's thinking is formulated, or, you know, the reflexive, you know, character of it frequently, are going to accuse me and you of, you know, singling him out for criticism of some sort just because we don't like him, or because he's a Democrat or some such thing. But, you know, the truth of the matter is whoever had won the 1992 election in the United States, whether it had been George W. H.W. Bush winning re-election or Clinton or anyone else, would have been the first American head of state in the post-Cold War, post-bipolar world, and would have been the person to issue in the current neoliberal order and the current situation of the U.S. expanding its presence internationally. Whoever had been that president would have done that. It just happened to be Clinton.
Oh, absolutely right.
We cannot talk about neoliberalism or the expansion of NATO into a global military force without, of necessity, mentioning the person who presided over that.
By the way, that was the only. It might have been the only election in modern U.S. history, at least in the last couple of generations. Well, at least. Oh, I don't know. I don't know when the previous one was. I want to say an independent candidate, Ross Perot, a kook. It happened to be a kook. I've met Ross Perot once.
Really?
I met him at a hotel in Dallas. Well, he knew who I was because we're almost out of time, but the business he was involved in was involved to some extent in some of the things that we did I don't have time to go into it, but we bumped into each other once in the Dallas hotel, and we chatted just for a couple of minutes. But I wasn't a real legitimate independent candidate, but it was the last time an independent candidate might possibly have had a chance of prevail. I don't think he really had a chance to win, but he got about 20% of the vote, and neither Bush nor Clinton got a majority. So that was the last election of this kind, and I think because of his candidacy, the decision was made by the powers that they're never going to allow any kind of an independent candidate into a race who might have any chance at all of getting anywhere near that amount of votes, percent of votes, even if they could rig the election to be sure that person didn't win. But we're just about out of time, Rick. Let me give you a final thought.
No, but I do agree with you on the 1992 election. Real quickly, the fact that somebody is like Perot, who's picked the worst possible vice presidential running mate, he himself, Perot, dropped out of his own campaign, made wild act, you know, whatever it is. If you couldn't have come up with a worst, you know, less viable option, and he still wins over 19% of the vote, that was a clear indication in 1992 that a sizable percentage of the American populace electorate was fed up with the political system, fed up with the two-party system, and would vote for damn near anybody to reject them. And you're also correct that, you know, the ruling elite, having seen, you know, how it could be done, made sure that it would never happen again. And nothing like it would happen again. So when, you know, campaigns like the Nader candidacies in 1996 and 2000 seem to be picking up some steam, they lowered the boom on it. And they'll make sure that never again is a third-party candidate given any opportunity of winning even local elections.
That's exactly right. And when independent candidates like Ralph Nader or the Green Party candidate this last November dared to even want to show up to observe the so-called presidential debates, they either bar them or they arrest them. That's the state of America today. Rick, thank you so much. We're out of time. I look forward to getting you back for more. It's terrific when you come on to explain these things. You're on the NATO story. Check out the Stop NATO website. It's an extremely vital resource. You'll get lots of information that's critical to understand because NATO is playing such a central global role, and it's completely destructive against the interests of the vast majority of people. So we need to know what NATO is up to, what it's doing, and you can find it out on the Stop NATO site. Thanks, Rick.
Thanks for all your work, Stephen.
Join us again over the weekend at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit.